this is Chief Judge Janet DeFiore. Over the past few months, the Gender Fairness Committee of the 3rd Judicial District, chaired by former Albany City Court Judge Rachel Kretzer, has produced a documentary about the pioneering women judges of the 7-county 3rd Judicial District. 9 groundbreaking judges were interviewed. Mae D'Agostino, judge of the United States District Court for the Northern District of New York; Catherine Doyle, former surrogate of Albany County; Victoria Graffio, former judge of the New York Court of Appeals; Helena Heath, judge of the Albany City Court; Rachel Kretzer, former judge of the Albany City Criminal Court; Karen Peters, the presiding justice of the Appellate Division 3rd Department; Beverly Tobin, former judge of the Albany County Family Court; Mary Work, former surrogate of Ulster County; and Deborah Young, judge of the Rensselaer County Court. Throughout the month of March, Women's History Month, we will share these interviews through our Amici podcasts. I think you will find the interviews of these trailblazing women to be both enlightening and inspiring.
It was brand new for all of the men at the firm to have a young woman, and that just created some uncertainty in terms of how to deal with me. We had events for many of our clients that were at places where women could not attend. We had events at country clubs that were not yet allowing women to be members. And I can remember going to the senior partner at the firm, and he was a big supporter of mine, Earl Jones Jr., and saying, "Mr. Jones, it is unfair that all of the young male associates are able to go to these events for our clients, and I'm not able to go." And his advice to me essentially was, "Well, you can entertain clients as well." And I would say, "But Mr. Jones, you know, I'm 25 years old. Do you expect me to call a 60-year-old man and ask him to go out to dinner with me? You know, it's not going to work."
Welcome to Amici, news and insight from the New York judiciary and the unified court system. I'm John Carr. You have just heard from United States District Judge Mae D'Agostino of the Northern District of New York. Judge D'Agostino, the first woman from the 3rd Judicial District ever to serve in the federal judiciary, is one of the pioneering judges profiled by the Gender Fairness Committee of the 3rd Judicial District. The committee, chaired by retired Albany City Judge Rachel Kretzer, interviewed 9 pioneers in the fall of 2016 and early winter of 2017 for a documentary project. Amici is featuring the audio from those interviews during Women's History Month, which of course is March. The documentary will be available on the Unified Court System website and through its YouTube channel. In the meantime, we hope you enjoy hearing from Judge D'Agostino as much as we did.
Just to start off, what inspired you to begin a legal career in the first place?
I think what inspired me to begin a legal career is that all my childhood and into elementary school and high school, I loved public speaking. I can remember back to second grade asking teachers if I could have narrator parts in school plays, even when there was no narrator. And when I got to high school, I thoroughly enjoyed debating and extemporaneous speaking. I continued that in college with National Model United Nations. And I loved persuasive speaking, and I loved doing it in front of a group. So I thought that the natural thing for me would be to become a trial lawyer, and I really never wavered from that. I began thinking about that at a very young age.
Was there ever a time when you thought maybe that was not open to you because of your gender, or that it was limited in any way?
It's interesting. I didn't think it wasn't open to me because many women, I think, will tell you that in an academic setting, we were as good as any boy or any man as long as we were doing our work. I always found that in academic settings, I was accepted for who I was. So going through college and law school and having met with some degree of academic success and some degree of success in the debating world, I never thought about not being accepted into the profession. I never thought that I would face any difficulties in law school, for example, and I didn't.
Any idea what percent of your class in law school was female, or would you guess?
I think that the percentage of my class, the breakdown, would probably be about 40% women, 60% male at the time.
That's a pretty high percentage.
Yes. Well, I went to law school between 1977 and 1980, and women had already made significant inroads in the profession and in law school at that time.
Now, your first job after law school, I don't remember what that was.
My first job after law school was with a firm here in Albany called Maynard O'Connor and Smith. And at the time, I was the only woman at the firm. It was a litigation firm, so I felt as though it was the best possible fit for me.
Was there any lack of acceptance there?
I wouldn't call my situation at Maynard O'Connor and Smith a lack of acceptance. I think that I was accepted, but like most women at that time, there were struggles. And what I mean by that is it was brand new for all of the men at the firm to have a young woman, and that just created some uncertainty in terms of how to deal with me. We had events for many of our clients that were at places where women could not attend. We had events at country clubs that were not yet allowing women to be members. And I can remember going to the senior partner at the firm, and he was a big supporter of mine, Earl Jones Jr., and saying, "Mr. Jones, it is unfair that all of the young male associates are able to go to these events for our clients, and I'm not able to go." And his advice to me essentially was, "Well, you can entertain clients as well." And I would say, "But Mr. Jones, you know, I'm 25 years old. Do you expect me to call a 60-year-old man and ask him to go out to dinner with me? You know, it's not going to work." So it took a long time, but eventually we stopped doing that type of entertainment that excluded me and other women who came after me at the firm. But it was all new territory, and I think that they supported me, but they were a little bit unsure about where this relationship was going to go at first.
So it sounds like what you're saying is it wasn't abject discrimination, but a curiosity and a period of them getting used to something unusual for them.
Definitely. At the first firm, I was a bit of a curiosity. And I also think that there were certain expectations in terms of whether I would be able to handle myself in this rough and tumble litigation world.
Well, you did that very quickly and very, very skillfully. And I didn't realize you'd started there. But, going back to when I first met you, you were, you know, clearly a star in the field. And so you certainly earned your stripes that way. And that must have had an effect on the firm and the partners, knowing that they had maybe done something they hadn't done or had rarely done, and then it was working out well.
Well, it did quickly work out well, thanks to a lot of support in the community. Many, many judges supported me when I first met them, and it was a different time then than it is now. It was a time when young lawyers actually tried cases. In my particular case, I probably tried 20 or 25 no-fault threshold cases in my first 2 years at the firm, and with some degree of success. And I found that a lot of the judges would call my law firm because it was new to them too. They had not seen a woman litigator, and they would call the senior partner in a non-official capacity and just say, "That young associate that you have is doing quite a good job," and that went a long way with the partners at the firm in terms of accepting me as a litigator.
I suppose if it had gone the other way, it would have been a real setback.
It certainly would have been a setback, but I don't mean to imply that there were no setbacks. One thing I think I should point out is that oftentimes when I and a few of the other women litigators in town would show up at a deposition or a trial, it was often presumed that we were the court reporter. And I love court reporters, so I mean no disrespect to them. I could have never survived in this profession without court reporters. But the fact that it would just be assumed that a woman was a court reporter, I think was, you know, really incredible. The other thing that stands out is that I was told often by judges how to dress. And what I mean by that is several Supreme Court justices advised me on the first day of trial that I was never to appear in their courtroom with pants on. Now, in the early 80s, women generally were wearing skirts and jackets to court, but I don't think too many men were told how to dress. And I had one judge tell me that if I ever showed up in his courtroom with a pair of pants on, I would essentially be sent home. Also, because it was a bit of a novelty at that time to have women in the profession, we had significant trouble getting into the courthouse. Even if I came to the courthouse with three briefcases and a blue pinstripe suit on and kind of looked the part, I would often be told at the door to wait there until my attorney arrived. And I found that a little disconcerting. So I would have to say to the person at the courthouse, well, actually, I am the attorney. And then I would usually be asked for some type of identification. So I don't think people were deliberately being mean-spirited, but we did have our obstacles when we began.
Did you adhere to the dress code at first?
I did, and I can remember the first day that I failed to adhere to the dress code probably wasn't until the late 80s or early 90s when I was actually trying a case with a woman who was my adversary. And I have to give the other lawyer credit. She came up to me, Betsy Dumas, and said, I will wear a pantsuit tomorrow if you will. And we were on trial in Troy. It was a medical malpractice case. For the life of me, I can not remember who the judge was, but I looked at her with great trepidation and I said, I hope we don't get in trouble. But she said, well, there's strength in numbers. So we both wore pantsuits and we survived. And after that, it became routine dress because it's just so much more easy for a trial lawyer to move about in a courtroom with a nice pantsuit on.
You mentioned earlier, I think, you know, kind of you felt a need to, when you went to MOS to prove yourself. Is that you felt a need to prove yourself because you were a very young new attorney, or a woman, or both?
Both. The first doctor that I represented found two problems with me, I think. One was youth, and I can fully understand that. But I think the second was that I was a woman. And I, you know, Albany is a very small community, and I remember hearing that the doctor was really worried about being represented by, quote, a young woman, end of quote. And I did what I've done my entire career. What I did was I approached him personally and said, Doctor, your observation that I'm young is correct. Your observation that I'm a woman is correct. But I am going to give you 110% of myself during this litigation. And I think you're going to be happy. And we got off on a footing that was not so great, but by the time I spent a week with him, we really became lifelong friends. So whenever I faced concern about the fact that I was a woman or that I was young, I would just deal with it head on and not try to hide the issue or put the issue under the carpet.
You must have been working a ton of hours. Were there work-life balance issues, family issues to balance?
There are immense work-life balancing issues for anyone who is a trial lawyer, but I believe that they are very much heightened when you are a wife and a mother. I will say very frankly that I think that one of the reasons my marriage did not last was because of all the hours that I worked. Now, that wasn't the only reason, but I think it contributed to it. In 1993, the best thing in the world happened to me. I adopted a little boy, and while that was and is the best thing I've ever done in my life, it presented all new challenges for me, because being a trial lawyer is 24/7, particularly in my field, medical malpractice. But I didn't adopt a child just to not be with him, so I had to make big changes in my life. First of all, I had to depend on a lot of people to help me with my son, my mother, my sister, my cousin. I had a network of people who would take care of him during the day. But then there were times when judges in this very courthouse where we are taping this would say to me, we're working until 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And I can remember vividly, it was on the third floor of this courthouse, when Judge Joseph Harris said to me, we're going to work until 9 p.m. today. My mother had had my child since 7:30 in the morning. It was a turning point in my life, because I didn't like to ask for help with the judiciary, but I asked, may I approach the bench? And I went up, and those of us who know Judge Harris or knew him knew that he could be a little bit intimidating. And I said, Your Honor, it's very difficult for me to work until 9 p.m. because I have a six-month-old baby home, and I haven't been with him since 7:30 this morning. And my first reaction was, I'm going to jail. I cannot believe I just said that. And Judge Harris leaned forward and said, you have a six-month-old baby? And I said, yes, I do, Your Honor. Take your seat. And I didn't know what he was going to do. He turned to the jury and he said, members of the jury, we are adjourning for the evening. We will return tomorrow morning at 9:30. That was a lesson for me, because previously I would have been afraid to ask. So this judge that I thought was pretty gruff and intimidating valued family as much as I did.
That's great. Any particular role models prior to your career and early in your career?
My main role model was a cousin of mine by the name of Mario Aquilino, who is a law professor at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. He was someone that really got me interested in a big way in reading and reading more and more difficult material when I was a child, because before he went to Georgetown, he went to Siena, and he spent a lot of time with my family. So I really credit him with broadening my horizons as a young child. And, you know, once I got into law school, I got very heavily involved in mock trial, and that allowed me to meet Stuart Jones Jr. as a student. I actually tried a mock trial against him, and I was absolutely in awe when I met him. I felt like I was walking in air, because I knew of his reputation in the Albany area. As I began practicing, I started to realize that there were very few women practicing in the Albany area. And I met Marge Caro, and in many ways, she became a great role model for me. I met Athena Core in Schenectady, a fabulous lawyer like Marge. There were no women judges for many, many years when I started practicing. So when I learned that Judge Kay had gone to the Court of Appeals, Judge Graffio had become a Supreme Court judge, Judge Karen Peters ascended to the bench, local and town justices, Judge Kretzer, people who are a few years older than I was, Judge Stahl. It was amazing to me that I was seeing women getting on the bench, because the first several years I practiced, there wasn't a woman to be seen on any of the courts where I practiced.
You were admitted in what year?
I was admitted in 81.
So it was two more years before Judge Kay broke the gender barrier for court of appeals. Did you recognize at the time that how significant of an event that was?
Oh, in my heart, I did. I was just so joyful. It was almost unbelievable to me that a woman could get that position. And I set out in my entire career to learn more about Judge Kay, to go to everything that she was at that I could possibly go to. And she is just somebody that I greatly admired, and the admiration grew over time.
You know, we talked about the early days. How have things changed and before you went to the bench? How have things progressed by, would you go five years ago, roughly?
I went on the bench about 5.5 years ago. And I think the main change in terms of litigation and women in the profession is just that we have many, many more women. In the Albany area, we now have some really excellent young litigators, and it's wonderful to see them both in the prosecution phase, as public defenders, as people involved in civil litigation. And I don't quite know if those young women fully understand the type of sacrifices that the older and more experienced women made along the way, you know, in order for them really, in some instances, to be seamlessly accepted in their field. I certainly think back to Judge Kay and some of those women who were litigators. When I first got out of law school, all of the questions that I had, all of the uncertainty as to whether I could do the balancing. I think young women today can easily pick up the phone and talk to another woman at any number of firms in the state of New York and ask pertinent questions, get those questions answered about what it's like to be a litigator. So I think it is very much improved, but it's still far from perfect.
Aside from perceptually, what difference does it make? And what I'm getting at is, I heard you talk once at the, I don't remember exactly what the event was. Was it the Bar Association? Maybe you had to be a judge or something. And you mentioned how at times Judge Treese would bring something up that because of his experience, you never would have thought of. That's kind of what I'm getting at. What does it matter that there's a woman on the bench, other than perceptually and as a matter of pride?
Well, I think having women on the bench and a diversified bench in general is critical to the institution of the courts. I say that knowing full well that judges, my view of judging anyway, is to follow the law. I did not become a federal judge to create law. I have a duty to follow the law. However, every human being of diverse background brings a different set of tools and a different sense of lifetime perceptions to the individual facts of a case and to the law that's going to be applied to the case. And one of the examples I do use is that Judge Randolph Treese, who was a magistrate judge with me, is African American. And sometimes we would be discussing in the past certain cases, and I realized that I was missing some components of the analysis that he had from his experiences growing up in Lansingburg and the way things were for African Americans then and now. So that was an example to me that life perceptions do have an impact about how you evaluate facts and law. So the more diversity, the better. The bench should reflect the society that it is serving. So I believe that women, people of color, people from diverse ethnic backgrounds do have an awful lot to add to this tapestry of justice.
How did you become a federal judge? Was gender an issue, pro or con?
It's hard for me to say. I know that Senator Schumer and President Obama appeared to be very, very committed to diversity on the bench. And so I have to think the fact that I was a woman and that I was a litigator helped me get considered for the position.
So you would be the first Northern District female judge in Albany. I think Judge Pooler
in
was
Albany,
the first.
In Albany, yes. We can't forget that Judge Pooler was the first judge of the Northern District of New York, and Judge Pooler now sits on the Second Circuit. Another hero to me.
So when you began sitting 5.5 years ago, that was an unprecedented sight in Albany because Judge Pooler would occasionally be in town.
Yes, yes. I never had the privilege of appearing in front of Judge Pooler when I was a trial lawyer, but I've had many conversations with her since I got on the bench, and she is totally supportive and very, very helpful. And she's been very active in the women's bar for years and years.
But speaking to the young women who are in law school now or just out of law school, what is the main thing you want them to know and remember about how things were when you started in around 1980?
I'd like them to know that things were not easy when I broke into the litigation business as a woman. And I would like them to know that while they've improved, they are responsible as they move through this profession and get older. They are the key to future success. What I mean by that is when law partners sit around a table and don't say things like they're concerned about whether or not a woman might have a pregnancy or whether a woman might need some type of leave, they may be thinking it. And that women have to support other women, both in law firms and in the judiciary setting. And women have to have a work ethic that demonstrates that they can do the job. So in other words, women older than me, those women who went to law school in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, I don't even know how they did it. I can't imagine what it would have been like to go to law school then and what it would have been like to practice then. The women who came in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we made it better for the younger generation. But they have to keep working. The struggle is not over because I honestly believe that sometimes while men and women at a law firm who are considering partners, of course they won't openly say, well, we're worried, you know, we're wondering if this person's going to have a family, we're wondering if they're going to take leave. That still kind of permeates the thought process. And men and women have families. So my message is, don't accept any of that nonsense. Do your work. Expect to be rewarded for your work, but also expect that in this society of ours, yes, men and women are entitled to maternity and paternity leave. That doesn't make you a lawyer who's not doing a good job, but just carry on. Don't be complacent. Don't think that everything has been achieved, because there still is a lot of subtle discrimination going on. And both in the state and the federal bench, we're still very, very much women underrepresented.
Even though the Court of Appeals, I think, now has a female majority and has many times in the last several years.
Well, that's one court. But mm-hmm. If you look nationally at statistics, women still are underrepresented in the judiciary. It's getting better, there's no doubt about it. But still, much more has to be done. I think women have to be trained in terms of the political route to a state court judgeship. Obviously, in federal court, we're not elected. It's very different, but it's very important for young women to get the message that when they get their first legal job, they have to work very hard at it. I don't care if their first legal job is doing real estate closings. Your reputation is everything. You be the best real estate closer that ever lived because your name is going to get out there. If you're at a litigation firm, you've got to juggle. I mean, you do have to juggle, especially if you have a family. But juggling can be done. And if you feel as though you want a career as a trial judge, I think that you have to do everything in your power to try to get some trial experience. That's for men and women. That's just not exclusive for women. It's hard to be a trial-level judge if you've had zero experience in litigation. I guess my final observation would be that I love seeing young women with tremendous success under their belt. More and more Assistant United States attorneys are prosecuting cases and high-level cases. More and more women are becoming senior partners at law firms, something that I wasn't sure I would ever see because so many women drop out of law firms when they're young because they find the juggling and the balancing to be too much. So I just hope that the younger generation, those women graduating from law school now, the recent grads, keep up their end of the bargain and keep women moving forward and not be afraid to make some sacrifices along the way. You never sacrifice your family, but you try to fit in as much as you possibly can in order to achieve your goals. If people become complacent now, all of the gains that women have made in the past will really be for nothing.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Amici. If you have a suggestion for a topic on Amici, call John Carr at 518-453-8669 or send him a note at jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.